Good morning. My name is Michael McCusker. We are at the cusp of the annual silly season, which begins with Memorial Day. Something to die for. I think I should state here my disclaimer that what you are about to hear on today's program, if you don't shut off your radio or switch to the AM dial, is my opinion and perhaps my opinion only in all the Valhallas of every bloody Mars. I'd like to start with something I wrote, Memorial Day. There's only one reason for Memorial Day, and that's to get more soldiers off to more wars and get them killed, a man argued with some of his friends. That's Dinky Dow, one of them snorted. Memorial Day is just remembering people who got killed in a war. Like us, maybe. That's all it is, nothing more. Another shook his head and agreed with the first man. When I was a kid, my mother used to take us every Memorial Day to see my dad's grave and put flowers on it. American Legion guys were always there making speeches and smiling at my mother and patting me and my brother on the head. They always told her what fine little soldiers we were. That's it exactly, the first man said. More meat for the butcher. They got your old man, now they got you. If you make it out of here and ever have a kid, they'll get him too. They were U.S. Marines in Vietnam 50 years ago, and it was Memorial Day 1966. Except for the usual infantry patrols, it was a day off from combat operations, which was about the best any of them could say about Memorial Day. Some of them tried to get sand and rust off their rifles. Others played poker or snuck off to the off-limits local villages to drink beer and pay for lovemaking. This particular group, at least for the time being, sat around and shot the bull, drinking warm beer one of them had bartered from a Vietnamese vendor on a bicycle. Later, they would roll some homegrown dope, but they had to be careful, more careful than later years when almost everybody smoked. I'm not even going to think about what we're doing here to these people. I'm just thinking about what's being done to us, the first man said. He was tall and knobbly and resembled a pissed-off owl with thick glasses and a nose hooked so prominently he was called Eagle Beak and the master of trivia for his esoteric knowledge of minutia. His name was Victor Llewellyn Payne, and he was a 20-year-old Lance Corporal in the USMC. He had been in the war several months. Death had become a preoccupation with him, as essentially a doomed sense of his own. Friends were dead, their bodies shattered. Some were picked off by snipers, others in startlingly sudden and terrible firefights. More often than not, booby traps and landmines killed them. What Payne didn't want to think about was the horror they inflicted upon Vietnamese, the incinerated villages, old people, women, and children whose napalmed bodies resembled burnt rubbish. The subject of death was common, as was that of fear. He and his friends talked about the ways they preferred to die and were unashamed of being afraid. Like Payne, many didn't like to think about what they did to the Vietnamese. Their major concern was about what the Vietnamese might do to them. They were not gung-ho about winning the war, or Vietnamese hearts and minds. They already knew in their own hearts and minds that the war was going to last long past their rotation dates. They simply wanted to do their 13 months, stay alive, and go back home to the world, as they called it. The first night ashore at Chulai, Payne said to his friends, "I can't believe people are out in those bushes waiting to kill me." Barely more than a month after Memorial Day, he was dead, his right arm and half his head blown off by a booby trap hanging in a tree on July 7th, 1966. The thought that if I get blown away, some son of a bitch uses my corpse as a Marine Corps recruiter next Memorial Day makes me so mad I hope I jump out of my grave and strangle the bastard with flowers, Payne said to his friends that Memorial Day half a century ago. And now, Recruiting Tomorrow's Dead, which I also wrote. The most shamelessly exploited minority in American society is its war dead. They died horribly, and most of them unwillingly, but they are not left to rot in peace. Their molding, mutilated corpses are eloquently exhumed as spearheads for the next war, their deaths extolled to recruit new armies. A language of lies develops. The dead always died for their country, heroically and nobly, and all of them willingly made the publicly acclaimed final sacrifice. None raped, pillaged, or burned, or committed other than sanctioned murder or terrorism. None died because of simple bad luck, or from their own stupidity, or that of their commanders, or from callous, asinine battle strategies. None died from accidental shelling or bombing by their own side, friendly fire. All of them were killed facing the enemy, not running away. Their deaths are glorified as justifications for the wars that killed them. Nations are haunted by their war dead. Monuments and memorials are built in every city and somewhere near the center of every town. The war dead assume a purity in death most would have found it difficult to attain in life. The official piety is that the cultural lifeblood is sustained by their deaths rather than drained, and only by sacrificing themselves in the same manner will the living gain a similar historical legitimacy. Service to the state is always a possibility to the young, and death in its service is presented as either an ideal or an unavoidable necessity. Families of the dead who should protest the slaughter of their young are instead coerced as willing accomplices in the demand that warfare is the only acceptable response to an unruly world. Those who resist that specious reasoning are compared to the heroic dead as unworthy cowards and traitors, implicitly responsible for their deaths. The irony of war deaths exploited as coercion for others to murder and die is lost in the thunder of voices calling for vengeance and righteous war. War survivors are used as shabbily as the dead. They are contained within government-sponsored veterans organizations that rubber-stamp their approval of everything military. They are given parades and empty honors. The horror of their war experiences is shielded from public view, gold-plated in boilerplate and pageantry. Yet they are undeniably representative of humanity's dark side that civilization attempts to disregard or abstract, even while perpetuating it through them. War is blood, carnage, and death, which is so obvious a fact we often ignore it in our obtuse preoccupation with the rationales, strategies, weapons, and machines of war. Each generation seems to think it should not be outdone by its predecessors. It must leave its bloody mark on history, no matter how absurd or pointless. Every generation has been incapable or unwilling to arrest the pattern of terror and suffering each inflicts on itself, and our own risks world holocaust because of a compulsive insistence that our era, which is noteworthy only because we live in it, be no less dramatic than the histories we imitate. Albert Schweitzer warned in 1924, 6 years after the end of World War I, that the suicide of civilization was in progress because humanity has lost, quote, the consciousness that every man is an object of concern because he is man. And he predicted that the advance of fully developed inhumanity was only a matter of time. We have talked for decades with ever-increasing light-mindedness about war and conquest, as if these were merely operations on a chessboard, Dr. Schweitzer wrote, asking how else that might be possible than as a result of a tone of mind which no longer pictured to itself the fate of individuals, but thought of them only as figures or objects belonging to the material world. Half a century later, philosopher Donald Wells offered another explanation. The problem of war and conquest and the diminished value of human life was not due to a vague tone of mind, but the demand of government authority over the masses. Wells wrote, "If it is presumed at the outset that the life of the state transcends that of the individual in value, indeed that the state is more important than all the citizens, then the fact of human death, on even a cosmic scale will prove irrelevant as an argument against war. Inhumanity is exclusively human. History seldom mentions compassion or the consciousness of every human being as an object of concern, as Schweitzer said, as vital ingredients to the structure of civilization. Humanity's history is of wars. The most fierce and acquisitive sweep away the gentle and least avaricious. It was that way when our hairy ancestors thrust pointed sticks into each other. It is that way now when the weapons of our industry are able to reduce continents to radioactive ash in minutes. The only real significance of the eternal conflicts of our species is the epic flow of blood, the slaughter of millions at each turn of history's gory pages for reasons as brief as their lives. The names of the multitudes are lost. Only their numbers are marked, aggregates of killers and killed. Our mental evolution of the past 10,000 years has not eradicated the savagery or the terror of our most primitive ancestors. We continue to regard every other human, and by extension, other cultures, nations, religions, and races, as our blood enemies. We continue to war, or think of war, as our right to dominate or destroy whoever is weaker, different, or in the way. We refuse to think of ourselves as parts of the same macro family, or to understand the rarity or privilege of life. Instead, we make war more ardently than love. War gives our lives a transcendent vitality that daily living and its squalid defeats squeeze out of us. We feel that we are a vital part of great events, that our normally diminished lives serve an important purpose at a watershed moment, and we are never so united, so able to collectively surmount tremendous obstacles as when we make war against each other. We make excuses for warfare and accept it as a consequence of living. We seldom think of war as our invention. We treat it instead as a natural phenomenon, an earthquake, a flood, or volcano. We feed its insatiable thirst for blood with the best blood stock we produce. Until recently, the highest honors a nation or people could bestow were upon the men who draped themselves in the blood of others. Life's heroes have always been the men of death. As with most other effects of rapacious technology, warfare has advanced far beyond nature's strictures of weather or geography. The world's militaries, even the poorest from the most obscure microstate, are able to make war anytime, any place. State-of-the-art weapons float around the world, sold by arms merchants to anyone with money, credit, or good prospects. The industrial nations are arms bazaars, producing and marketing exotic weapons systems, vicariously enraptured by the increased carnage rockets and jet fighter bombers make of tribal-level squabbles. Perhaps abstract engagement in wars made possible by outlandish weapons designed in the manner of video games is verification of the popularity of reality as image devoid of involvement. This de facto decadence might be related to the hallucinatory dread of nuclear obliteration, which has been almost too large a horror to bear for three quarters of a century. It seems inconceivable that humanity has made itself capable of its own extinction, and that by our own will we can disappear from history as absolutely as dinosaurs and dodo birds. Most folks refuse to think we could be so foolish. Yet they suspect our leaders have few qualms or sufficient fears, urged to the possibility of the unthinkable by prospects of opportunity. We turn away as we would from a glare of sunlight. We submerge into banality to mute our angst. Genesis might be a warning. Instead of a myth of divine creation, it is a prophecy of mega-death. Perhaps we are still in the Garden of Eden, which is a metaphor for life. Evil might not be sex after all, or knowledge, but humanity's reckless ferocity that leads irresistibly toward the plucking the ripe fruit of speciesicide. War has advanced civilization as brutally as it has destroyed civilizations. Humanity is as rotely accustomed to warfare as breathing and fornicating. We are a killing species. We rule Earth because our ancestors were clever, ruthless, and well-organized predators, and we have always butchered our own as readily as any other creatures. We kill individually, which is murder, or we organize murder and name it war. We have throughout history honored the killers among us, and as we have become more settled and civilized, the laurels inevitably transferred from the stealthy hunters of animals to the slayers of human beings. All of our great civilizations and empires have been structured on the expenditure of human blood, the conquest and often decimation of tribes, cities, or nations, unlucky to be along the march of more militant, ambitious societies. War has affected civilization tremendously, but its effect upon those who suffer firsthand is given little consideration. Wars determine the reaction and consequent effect upon a society, and recovery is often a long, slow process. Those with personal involvement in a war are not accorded the same respect for their own process of recovery. Their private horrors and nightmares of war are dealt with impatiently and with scorn at possible psychological or physical disabilities, although collectively, these sorts of disruptions and discontinuities are accepted as part of a historical occurrence. The ambiguity of history might be encompassed in a phrase often used by Oliver Cromwell and others, pray for peace, prepare for war. Earth bristles with preparation. Yet a grim irony of this Brobdingnagian era is that we have reduced human participation in warfare, with an exception of possibly dying in appalling numbers. The invention of the harpoon gun, an exploding harpoon, decimated the world's whales. The chainsaw has clear-cut Earth's forests. By also inventing such weapons as the machine gun and hydrogen bomb, we nearly match our feckless despoliation of the home planet by abetting our own extinction. We have perfected war, refined it to an instrument of digital logic that no longer depends upon human rationale or justification. No philosophy or psychology, only strategy and provocation. Although armies might seem superfluous, they are useful for performing traditional fratricide short of provoking megadeath. Dead soldiers are Christ-like in a sense. They die as surrogates for the rest of us. Unrestricted warfare in the previous century significantly enlarged soldiers' always shadowy and disavowed role as surrogate executioners. Although Americans like to think of themselves as a peaceable society, we are among history's most successfully warlike. Our nation was created by war, maintained its union by war, became a continental power by invading our southern neighbor and stripping it of its northern half, and surged to a world power by terminating the decrepit colonial empire of another. The two world wars made the USA a superpower, during which we built a war machine unsurpassed in history while demonstrating a productive capacity that overwhelmed allies and enemies alike. This nation now dominates global politics with its immense and highly sophisticated potential for total war as the only reigning superpower after emerging successfully from a half-century Cold War against Soviet Russia, which was characterized by inconclusive brushfire wars and a horrendous nuclear arms race that economically and politically broke our competitor, but seriously rattled our own economic and ideological stability and possibly unhinged our sanities. In all, the USA has fought in 11 major wars, but memory should not neglect the incessant three-century war against Native Americans, which is comparably among the most savage and genocidal ever fought. Our expansion across the continent, our manifest destiny, necessitated in the minds of the expansionists virtual extermination of the primeval tribes, whose brave but pitiless resistance against extinction was no match for our weapons and determination to possess their homelands. To this purpose, in addition to obliteration of any tribe within reach, was the use of biocides, the deliberate spread of smallpox among tribes who might more adequately defend their territory than others. looking at history through only the bloody prism of war is to miss much of the best of it and distorts it. Yet war shapes nations and individuals. Much of what each claims as heritage and honor is bequeathed by war. Waging war is a nation's most serious business. Robert E. Lee said it was probably fortunate war is so terrible, otherwise we might grow to love it. He did not foresee its possibilities as video entertainment, such as the Persian Gulf War and the air wars over Serbia, Iraq, Afghanistan, and Syria. Robot drones and smart missiles breaking down doors and falling through industrial chimneys. High-tech stuff in which sky warriors, anonymously and indiscriminately, always hotly denied, murder strangers from the stratosphere. Most significant to the human psyche is that a century of air warfare has made the very sky that envelops the earth the most dangerous threat to existence. There is no good war and no bad peace, Benjamin Franklin said. But peace is also considered as a period between wars, a time to bury the dead, lick wounds, produce more and newer weapons, sow newer crops of human fodder to resume the genocides of their parents. It is difficult to separate peace from its evil twin, war, not unlike concentrating on yang without including yin. Peace and war are joined at the hip, human perceptions that have no parallel in nature, which is of course violent as well as simultaneously nonviolent, from weather to the symbiosis between predator and prey. The questions of how to end warfare are as ancient but never as popular as promoting it. The few who raise the issue of abolishing war have been imprisoned, exiled, or executed through the centuries. At the very least, they are ostracized or ridiculed. Pacifism exudes an odor of weakness and appeasement, and pacifists are accused of being agents or dupes of an enemy. Pacifists are sneered at in times of war fervor and told to live in the real world, the human world in which we have relatively recently been informed that the destruction of humanity by nuclear weapons is a sound military option. The central, most agonizing enigma is whether some principles are worth the risk of annihilation. Human life and possibly all organic existence is conceivably so rare in the universe that its loss as a result of dispute over abstract principles peculiar to a point in time would be more intolerable than the loss of those principles, which, human in origin, would just as surely evaporate in a Holocaust. What difference does it make to the dead, Gandhi asked, whether the mad destruction is wrought under the name of totalitarianism or the holy names of liberty and democracy? Solutions to warfare have been ambiguous, insipid, and often ridiculous. Most pacifists agree that the only end to warfare will be a world state of some form, but one world theories range from a loose federation of states, not unlike the United Nations, with the exception that its laws would be binding, to naked utopias and otherworldly Edens, or more ominously, Orwellian or Huxleyan nightmares of rigid authority and mind control, as well as perpetual war. Pacifists are themselves in conflict. Whatever their disagreements and varied visions, pacifists usually look down the long road instead of being gripped by the frenzies of the moment, and wish not only to live their own lives in peace, but for it to become the normal condition of humanity. They have grim prophecies of humanity's future if it continues to make war upon itself. Pacifists seem to hope we might at least elevate beyond war and self-induced apocalypse to a loftier plane of thought and compassion before we blow ourselves out like an extinguished candle. The most likely possibilities toward peace acknowledge the necessity of alternatives to warfare to engage its immense energies. Philosopher William James suggested in 1914, the year World War I began, that there ought to be a moral equivalent to warfare. And although his idea that society exhibit the pomp and circumstance of a Gilbert and Sullivan operetta was rather silly, but not out of context with his pompous era, he also thought that so long as the anti-militarists propose no substitute, no moral equivalent to war, the duties, penalties, and sanctions pictured in the utopias they paint are all too weak and tame to touch the military-minded. That is precisely the point. Militarism rules the planet at every level of education and are incorporated in the root systems of societal values. Militarism is the antithesis of liberty and democracy, and its justice is based on obedience and servitude. The economies of most nations are poured into war machines that posture as defensive instruments, and world leaders blackmail their populations with terror, force them to surrender their lives and their children's futures, their wealth and liberties if they possess either, to the gross appetites and deadly illusions of military power. Nightmares of doom are disguised as dream worlds of prosperity. Armageddon is the place for the last battle at the end of the world. Almost all religions and myths prophesize a final conflict or cataclysm that will terminate human life, and our history has brought us to the savage frontier of our most primitive fears. Military castes have been as irresponsible as priests in exhorting doom. They speak of themselves as guardians of peace, but prepare the methods for final combat, which is, after all, the shrine of their profession. War is to a man what childbirth is to a woman, Benito Mussolini was fond of saying. Putting an end to warfare will not end human conflict or greed, but war should be put aside as a toy of our youth. The ancient assumption that war weeds out the weak, unfit, and unlucky to ensure strengthened future generations has been disproved by the enormous and indiscriminately devastating wars of the 20th century. History's dark glare shines on an earth too fragile for the titanic clashes of its past. The United States commemorates its war dead on Memorial Day, which is at the end of May. It would be the proper occasion to pierce the illusions and deceptions and remember that the hallowed dead would bitterly protest being used to kill others, and to take note of something written by Boris Vann. The day nobody comes back from a war, it will be because war has at last been properly organized. And that was Recruiting Tomorrow's Dead. Memorial Day this year happens to fall upon its original date of May 30th. Memorial Day was first established as a single day of national mourning for its war dead, with a powerful element of jingoism inherent, inspired by the Civil War in which everyone killed on either side or caught in between was an American, including slaves. The questions of just and unjust wars are momentarily transcended by annual recognition of their grim costs. Memorial Day should return to a single day, May 30th, as it was traditionally, and to be regarded in its original intent or discarded entirely. The present three-day holiday makes a mockery of commemoration of the nation's war dead, and public ceremonies appear tawdry and comically manipulative. If we are to honor Memorial Day, we should do it for real. The same with Labor Day. Unions don't march anymore. Each seems to be little more than a bookend holiday, marking the beginning and end of the annual silly season. Both have been trivialized to little more than facades for commercially sponsored partying. Chambers of commerce will yowl at any such return to basics, of course, and regard it as obviously anti-business, as well as palpably unpatriotic. Perhaps public celebrations are meant to go only skin deep as insipid, officially sanctioned observances to ease the itch of nagging deeper reflections that might be dangerous because they profoundly affect us individually and as a nation. And I'd like to end this program with a couple of poems. The first by William Stafford, which he wrote in 1945, The End of the War. All violent, like the knife that drove the pity begging life out through the eyes and wilted the choked voice in little cries that bubbled and blinked out along the floor. all hungry like the outlaw stare that tore the north and reeled the rivers in along the spool that never would unwind them any more to wander cool, but stretch them taut to all that's far away. All lost by dusty roads, all fled with love, all hid along with play, all hurt by what we lost who conquered in the war, so violent, so lost, so far away. And that was by William Stafford. I'm sure everyone listening to this program is aware that William Stafford was Oregon's longtime poet laureate from 1975 to 1990. He was also poet laureate of the United States in 1970. He died in 1993, and during World War II, he was a conscientious objector fighting forest fires here in the Northwest. And finally, I print and read a poem by Elaine Green that she sent for me to use in the third resurrection of my newspaper, the North Coast Times Eagle, which was not born again after all. She said it was a riff on cliches about some of the paper's issues. So here it is, 6 years later, the fog of war. Hard dogs to keep on the porch, those pesky dogs of war, always whining and scratching at the gate, waiting for a kindred spirit to set them free some misty, moonless night when no one is about to cry havoc or even ask who let the dogs out. And that was by Elaine B. Green, The Fog of War. And this has been Michael McCusker. Have a memorable Memorial Day.